loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, for the first time in nearly 30 years, West Virginia teachers plan a statewide strike to protest low wages and rising health care costs. The state ranks 38th in the nation in the quality of public education. Next, Border Patrol agents are working on private property without permission and setting up so-called border checkpoints 100 miles inland from any border under a little-known federal law that was ignored until Donald Trump became president. And then Brazil's military was put in charge of security in Rio de Janeiro, the country's largest city, over the weekend, as gang violence continues to escalate. And then Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced that he will arrange for the deployment of an elite unit of Pakistani guards to protect him and other royal family members, ostensibly from his own people. And finally, the anniversary of Ukraine's 2014 revolution, what many people call a coup, is today. We take a look at this regime change effort that brought to power a far-right, pro-Western government. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to West Virginia. For the first time in nearly 30 years, West Virginia teachers plan a statewide strike to protest low wages and rising health care costs. The state ranks 38th in the nation in the quality of public education. We're joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by Frank Ariette. He is a community organizer. And we're also joined from Morgantown by Travis Booth. He's an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Thank you all for having us.
Travis, let's start with you. Tell us exactly what's behind this strike. You know, teachers across the country are so poorly paid. That's not really something new. What makes this year so bad that all the teachers in the entire state go on strike?
Well, I mean, this is really kind of just the boiling point of a couple of different years of really just insulting behavior on behalf of the West Virginia State Legislature in the way that they've been treating teachers and other educational service personnel across the state. In addition to the low wages that you mentioned, you know, across the board for teachers, West Virginia is especially hard hit by that. They haven't seen adequate raises for years now. But more importantly, teachers are more frustrated with the rising cost of our health care program, the Public Employees Insurance Agency, otherwise known as PEIA. They're actually being asked to contribute more and more of their own personal money into it. I believe that they're asking for 60-40. You know, Frank right here might know more about that, the specifics of the numbers and everything. This is compared to 80-20 before, and combined with the low increase in wages, what's actually happening is a de facto wage cut for all teachers across the state right now.
Frank, let me ask you a question, too. I want you to talk about that, but I also want you to address something else. It's as though the state has started off their negotiations with the nuclear option. You've got the attorney general saying that any statewide strike is illegal. And then he's citing a 1990 state Supreme Court decision saying that public employees have no right to strike in the absence of express legislation or at the very least appropriate statutory provisions for collective bargaining, mediation and arbitration. In fact, they do have the right to strike. So is there any middle ground here?
Unfortunately, with the way that the state legislature has been going for the past couple of years, you know, they're really trying to put this ultimatum that they have to accept this or lose their jobs. But, you know, I think with the sheer size of the strike, I think that is going to be the real power in the fight for the teachers' pay and better benefits. Because there's no way they're going to be able to lay off thousands of teachers. So I think it's more of a scare tactic. You know, as far as like the insurance program, you know, what Travis was saying, you know, to add on to that, they're also changing what they consider eligible income, which means that, okay, as it is right now, it's only the teacher's income. You know, whoever is a state employee, it's only their income that's taken into account for how much their premiums are. Well, they're changing that to include everybody in the household, which means that, you know, if the spouse makes more than the teacher, well, that's taken into account and the premium goes up, which makes this proposed 1% raise really insulting, because at the end of the day, they only are going to make on average $23 more per month, but then they're going to have to pay an extra maybe $200 or more per month.
That's not even a meager, measly 1% raise. That's a pay cut.
It's a pay cut. In real terms, they'll make less money next year than they did the previous year. I'm looking at a piece in the West Virginia Gazette Mail. And it's a little bit disturbing to me. It says here that union lawyers are prepared to defend employees, but the West Virginia Education Association president, Dale Lee, it says, when asked whether he believes the widespread work stoppages he and other public school employee union leaders have called for are illegal, he said, probably yes. How is it that teachers in a state like West Virginia, which frankly has a very long history of union participation, would be illegal? How did that happen?
And why would someone admit it? Why
would you admit it? That's a good point, Brian. Why would you admit it knowing that you're probably headed into some kind of arbitration or legal case?
Well, I think...
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question. You know, what exactly is going on right now? But I think that to understand this, we really had to put it into the context of a long history in recent times of assaults on working people's rights. You know, you mentioned at the start of the segment that this sort of action hasn't occurred since 28 years ago in 1990,
yes,
when teachers also went on massive strikes across the state in 54 out of 55 counties, demanding higher pay, and it ultimately led to the creation of faculty senates in every single school across the state to address some of the concerns of teachers and other faculty staff. You know, so I mean, this sort of action really hasn't happened in so long that I think it's really out of the memories of a lot of people. So, you know, maybe they're trying to, as a matter of tactics, you know, really bring this into the forefront and, you know, maybe accept responsibility as the leadership so that the individual rank and file don't, you know, take the brunt of legal actions from the state. You know, maybe that's their thinking. I really can't say.
Yeah, you know, sometimes, of course, there's the wink and the nod.
Right.
Where, you know, union leaders, I've been there myself, where you're barred from striking, or your contract bars you from walking out, and you're faced with a terrible problem, let's say a health and safety issue on the job, and the union leadership can't authorize a strike. So you have what in essence is a wildcat. And the union says to everybody, and whatever you do, this is illegal, don't go on strike, and then winks, and everybody understands. Yeah. Is that what we're looking at? 3 minutes left, guys. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's the case. Just one little point, and I'll let Frank take us out on this segment, is at a rally on this past Saturday, February 17th, Vice President of the National Education Association, Becky Pringle, was actually in Charleston, West Virginia, addressing union members who had gathered on the Capitol footsteps. And according to her words that she used in that statement, which you can find on the Gazette Mail as well, she said that in her opinion, teachers are willing to quote unquote do what it takes to get what they deserve. So I think that that's exactly what we're seeing right now. And I think it's fairly exciting.
Yeah, Frank, of course, all across the country, teachers right now and the teachers' unions, this was particularly true in Chicago a couple of years ago, teachers' unions have been taking some of the most important militant job actions in the country on the part of labor. We know private sector unions have been, you know, essentially decimated. The number of days lost for strikes in 2017 was, I think, at an almost all-time record low. Again, teachers are looking to teachers in other places in the country. If the West Virginia teachers strike, and it's going to be harder there, but if they do, undoubtedly, teachers from around the country are going to be looking, hoping, showing solidarity. This is an important battle, not just for your state, but for the country. Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is a major action, as Travis has said, and you have stated since 1990. And I think this is really going to empower teachers across the nation, as well as, you know, workers across the nation, that even though, you know, as you guys stated, that even the union boss has stated this might be illegal, but still the fact that people are still able and willing to stand up for their rights as workers. You know, I think that this is going to be a major, I really think that the eyes of the workers are really watching West Virginia right now to see what happens, you know. So it's going to be a real interesting couple of weeks to see how this resolves.
You know, I think that's really the important point. I think the bigger picture here is that this isn't necessarily about a teacher strike. This is about workers' rights to unionize and to organize and to demand their rights. I think that it's not the strike that we're going to be looking at a year from now. It's new legislation or a state Supreme Court decision that's going to allow them to strike.
Yeah, and I want to say one other thing about that issue, because, you know, it's against the Constitution to say workers don't have a right to withhold their
that's
labor.
Right.
The 13th Amendment of the Constitution says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. That means workers have the right to strike. They have a right to withhold their labor. That's the only weapon workers actually have on the job for justice. And now you have the states trying to pass laws that are not legal. So undoubtedly, if workers and if their unions are going to win, they're going to have to engage in strikes that may not be legal, but actually are lawful from the point of view of constitutional rights.
This is something we're going to have to keep watching and fighting for. I'm sorry that we're out of time, though. We were joined from Morgantown, West Virginia, by both Frank Arriet, he's a community organizer, and by Travis Booth. Travis is an organizer with the Morgantown Tenants Union. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Border Patrol agents are working on private property without permission and setting up so-called border checkpoints as much as 100 miles inland from any border under a little-known federal law that was ignored until Donald Trump became president. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Isabel, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Isabel, on Facebook, you will see every once in a while someone post a video of an encounter with a Border Patrol agent, nowhere near a border. I've seen videos of people being confronted north of San Diego, for example. More than 50 or 60 miles inland. And the Border Patrol actually has the legal right to do that kind of thing. Most Americans don't know that. Can you talk about the Border Patrol and its authority off the border? What exactly can the Border Patrol do?
Yes, I'm telling you, obviously, I believe that the Border Patrol acts outside its authority. But talking about these checkpoints, these checkpoints, I believe, are unconstitutional. I know that the Supreme Court says that they're constitutional, but think about it. The Fourth Amendment guarantees us a right to be safe in our person, our property, anytime. And these checkpoints violate that for no good reason. And they've said, you know, that they're lawful. So the Border Patrol has been constructing checkpoints, doing roving patrols for a very long time. And the problem is that most Americans, most people in the public aren't paying attention. When Julie Myers in, I think it was December of 2004, right, or five, right before the Real Waiver Act was enacted, she, in some raids in, I believe it was some Swiss plants in the Colorado region, she stated what we've been saying for a long time. This is to signal that enforcement will not stay at the border. And people have not paid attention. That as goes the border, goes the rest of the country. And so, yes, now that we are, since 2008, have experienced a real downturn in terms of the number of people coming in. Now, we're still at the lowest in over 45 years in terms of entrance. And, but of course, nobody knows that, right? Because right. the rest of the public thinks that we're being overrun as we speak with not people not understanding that they're not crossing, that they want increases to the Border Patrol and ICE to do what? To do exactly what we said would happen 20 years ago, which is it's to patrol us. So ICE, for the first time, I guess, ever, last month or 2 months ago, it came out that the arrest in the interior were greater for the first time than the arrest at the border.
Ah, and
voila.
That says a lot. You
we
know, I'm looking.
A police
I'm looking at an ACLU a page. It's the American Civil Liberties Union of Arizona. And it says, know your rights with the Border Patrol. If you are in a car, it says, Border Patrol roving patrols cannot pull over vehicles to question occupants about their immigration status unless agents have a reasonable suspicion of an immigration violation or a crime. Reasonable suspicion is more than just a hunch. It is illegal, and this is in bold on the website, it is illegal for Border Patrol to rely on the race or ethnicity of a driver or passenger to justify a stop. But they do that every day, don't they?
Well, but yes, but guess what? The Supreme Court in Brignone Ponce, I believe it was 79, I believe, made a big mistake. They said you cannot rely solely on the racial appearance of the person. So what do you think happens here? What they say is it was riding really low. It was really riding high. The occupants looked at me. The occupants didn't look at me. I mean, they make up any pretext. And this goes not only for the Border Patrol. We are experiencing what DHS has in mind for all of us, and that is for all of our police forces to be in line with them and be like their auxiliary or their front line. Here in Arizona, in Pima County, the Board of Supervisors took a courageous stance and said, we are not going to receive federal Operation Stone Garden monies because it's being used to enforce immigration laws, copy problems, all these great things. And of course, they got to one of the supervisors and just yesterday overturned that. And what did we hear in that hearing? I mean, there were countless numbers of people that said, yes, they stopped me. The checkpoint is populated not only with Border Patrol, with the Pima County sheriffs there. The Border Patrol will stop somebody and call the sheriffs. The sheriffs will stop somebody. This is mainly the case. Border Patrol will call them and, you know, stop that car, and the sheriff will go and stop the car, and they question them. They don't have papers, and so they bust up a family right there. I gave testimony yesterday about a 2009 case, a man racially profiled by Pima County Sheriff's Office. They stopped him for no good reason. They called the Border Patrol. Border Patrol had to, you know, expend money at that time, so they deported him through Mexicali. We're in Tucson here. So they did lateral repatriation, is what euphemistically they call it, just making their life difficult. And this guy, as he was trying to come over, he died. He had 5 U.S. citizen children, worked 3 jobs to support his U.S. citizen wife and children, and this was a racial profiling.
Yeah, a murderous racial profiling. Isabel Garcia is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe to our podcast. John Kiriakou, I'm looking at the New York Times. I'm sure you've seen it. It's today's article.
Right.
Under Trump, Border Patrol step up searches far from the border. A couple sentences. Border Patrol officers are working without permission on private property and setting up checkpoints up to 100 miles away from the border under a little-known federal law that is being used more widely in the Trump administration's aggressive crackdown on illegal immigration. In New Hampshire, border officers working with state officers conducted what the ACLU described as illegal drug searches. And most recently in Florida, New York, and Washington State, Border Patrol officers have been criticized for boarding buses and trains to question riders, mostly American citizens, about their immigration status. And there's a picture of a cop on a Greyhound bus, an ICE officer, and finally he takes a woman off the bus. I mean, it feels
here all the time.
It feels like it. You know, it's the kind of imagery that you get from Germany.
Sure, papers, please.
Papers, please.
Yes.
Police state.
Yes.
Police state.
Indeed.
Some of us live in conditions of police state, and people don't understand. Yes, is it illegal for them to racially profile? Absolutely. But do they do it? Absolutely. They get away with it, despite all the testimony anybody can provide. You know, they're going to continue. And as you can see, they've taken a very strong political posture. When have law enforcement agencies ever in history been so politically involved? This is very dangerous. They are promoting themselves. They don't want to cut. They sued President Obama because he exercised prosecutorial discretion. I mean, this is where we're going. And yes, they're stopping people. They're going 100 miles in. Congressman Bishop from Nevada and other places from, you know, Peter King, all these people claim
that
they know the border and that we should 100 miles in be a totally constitutional free, rights-free zone. That's what they want, 100 miles. We are 56 miles from the border here in Tucson.
Isabel, we have under a minute left, but I want to ask you to comment about another thing that's in this New York Times article. A man who owns a farm within 25 miles of the border in Texas noticed a camera, a surveillance camera that had been placed on his property. It turned out to be a Border Patrol surveillance camera. But the law says that the Border Patrol is allowed to go onto your property and do whatever they want if you live within 25 miles of the border. We've got 20 seconds. Go ahead and wrap it up.
Well, I challenge that. I do not believe that they have the authority to do that. Yes, have they been given, you know, unprecedented powers? But this is too much. You cannot do that. Even in Texas, when we know there's dead bodies out there in private ranches, they don't go onto the property. So, you know, it is what we allow.
Yeah.
So the rights we have are what we demand.
That's right. And that's why we have to stand up. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We were joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia. Isabel is the co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Thanks for joining us, Isabel. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Brazil's military was put in charge of security in Rio de Janeiro, the country's largest city, over the weekend as gang violence continues to escalate. We're joined in the studio by Aline Piva. She's with the group Brazilian Expats for Democracy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So this is a major development. The Minister of Justice, you noted just before we went on the air, has said that that this is an asymmetrical war that the government is fighting against crime in Rio. We know that murders are up, robberies are up, carjackings are up. But what does this do about the rights of people to defend themselves?
Well, I think first of all, we need to put this in context. Yes, Rio is a very violent city, but it's not even the most violent city in the country. I think it's number 10 on the list or something like this. And then we need also to put it in the context of a broader political situation in the country. Everything that is happening now, it is happening within a breach of constitution that has been coming, you know, since the coup against Rousseff. And now what we have is that for the first time since the redemocratization of the country, we have the militaries taking over, you know, civil responsibilities. That is very dangerous. That sets a very dangerous precedent, not only for Rio, but for the whole country. I mean, what can they do? They could take this to other states of the country. But, you know, this is an unprecedented power for the military, and they are not happy with that. They want more. As you said, they think they are waging an asymmetric war against organized crime, and they wanted people to be treated as, And I mean, I don't even know if we can call this a legal loophole, but they wanted to do the same legal precedents that they did here with Guantanamo, you know, treat people as combatant enemies. And they also want a carte blanche for just do whatever atrocities. I think it was a couple of days ago, we have General Villas-Boas, which is like a commander-in-chief for the military. And he said that the military, the army was willing to do whatever it takes as long as the government gave, you know, changed the legislation and assured that the army would never have to face a truth commission again. So I don't know if people it's familiar with what the Truth Commission was. It was instated by Dilma Rousseff. So for the first time, we had the military legally responding for the atrocities they committed under the military dictatorship.
So just for our broader audience, there was a military coup d'etat in Brazil, favored by the United States, supported by the United States, supported by the CIA. And a military rule was imposed on the people of Brazil. They lost all of their rights. Now what we see happening, perhaps the issue of crime is a pretext, that the real issue is politics, because there was a legislative coup against the democratically elected government of Dilma Rousseff, the Workers' Party, and now the allegations and convictions of Lula, the founder of the Workers' Party, who would undoubtedly and may still run the presidency in 2018, but it provides a legal clout over him. So now the military is saying, well, we're launching asymmetric warfare. Again, as Alina Pive is mentioning, this also means it connotes no rights for those who are the targets, because if they're enemy combatants rather than citizens, of course, they have no rights, like the people in Guantanamo have no rights. And then we have a situation where the military can't really come in and take power and say, guess what? We don't like the Workers' Party. We don't like their social reforms. We don't like the fact that there's a democracy that challenges our hegemony inside Brazilian society. So we're going to carry out a military coup d'etat. They have to have a pretext. They have to have a noble cause. The government can't function. The military functions as the national savior of the people. But nonetheless, it's a return, slow motion, incrementally, to the days of military dictatorship. That's where this is going.
Exactly. So, and this is very important, because when they were discussing Rousseff's impeachment, there was that audio that came out. We discussed it here, Juca's audio. And in that audio, he said, that's okay, the military is supporting us. They are going to be, you know, supporting everything that we
meaning,
do here.
Meaning supporting the people who are carrying out the legislative coup d'etat against the elected president, Dilma Rousseff.
Exactly, exactly. And then what Temer did, because the military was never, you know, in the front page. They were doing like this covered thing, you know, support of the coup. So what Temer did, increased the fundings for the military. And also what they did is that they appointed this guy, General Echegoyen, to be the head of a being of the Brazilian intelligence agency. And now what we are seeing is that, and many analysts has been pointing this for some time, is that the military want more. So we have a kind of divide within the military. There is the group of the hardline militaries that are Echegoyen's group, and the kind of little more soft military, if we can say that, that is behind Villas-Boas. What this intervention could mean is that for the first time since the coup against Rousseff, the hard line is taking control again. And it's imposing a more aggressive agenda to keep supporting the coup. And one more thing, you know, in Brazilian constitution, when we are under intervention, the Congress can make changes in legislation. And then we need to remind that the most important piece of legislation was the changes in the retirement laws in the country. And Temer doesn't have the support he needs to go on with that legislation. So now they move the focus from corruption, from that legislation, from, you know, his lack of support, and then we start this war against organized crime. So yeah,
this is a power grab,
and it's the Richard Nixon law and order strategy. The military, the police, the government have to keep us safe, and so give us all the power. Give up your constitution. Give up your rights.
And as Alini says, it also distracts people from the political issues that are at hand. I mean, this really was a coup. We've said it here on this program. Most Brazilians say that it was a coup, but he wants to turn the debate away from that and onto law and order.
Yeah, and so the issues affecting working class and middle class and poor families, especially when it comes to pensions, they're trying to pursue a neoliberal policy to privatize everything, to make everything up for grabs, to, you know, sort of shred the social safety net. And at the same time say, well, you know what? Criminals are running our country. We need the military. We need a strong hand. I mean, that's what always happens. And I think, Alini, the point that you're making is important, that even within the military, there are going to be different wings. Like take the Pinochet coup d'etat in Chile in September 1973. There was another wing of the Chilean military that wanted the military to uphold democracy, allow civilian government, allow Allende to go forward. But then the right wingers got the upper hand, and they got the upper hand also not only because of economic dislocation, but also because of the intervention of the CIA. Do you see the hand of the U.S. anywhere in this Brazilian political situation at the moment?
Well, there were weekly cables that said that Temer, before the coup, I think a couple of years before the coup, they were actually working with the U.S. embassy regarding the royalties, oil royalties in the country. I mean, history tells us that, you know, that could be, but I can't say, because we don't have yet the facts to make that claim.
Yeah, we'll get the classified cables in 30 years, John.
Yeah, but maybe 50 years.
Maybe 50 years. But there's no doubt, I feel there's no doubt that anything that happens in the Western Hemisphere, anything that happens in Latin America, anything that happens in a country so big, and Brazil, of course, is the biggest country in Latin America, the U.S. has a disinterested attitude. Alina, real quick, we have about a minute left. The elections are coming up. Will Lula run? Can he run? Can he win? Can he assume office?
Well, he can run, but we don't have any guarantees that he will actually be able to take office. For now, he continue campaigning. He is leading all the polls. I think he has almost 60% of the intentions of votes in the country right now. But again, you know, the persecution against him and the undermining of his legitimacy is very important for the coup mongers. You know, it doesn't make any sense to organize all this, to roll back all social rights, and then you just get this very powerful, very important political figure to, you know, win the elections and roll back everything. So I think it is yet to be seen if we are going to have elections, and this military intervention may be, you know, the first.
The opening shot. Aline's right, John. If the government, if the justice ministry says they're involved in asymmetrical war against a part of their own population, that means the rules of war are different than the rules of democracy. There is no democracy in war.
That's right. And they seem to be willing to cross that line.
Yeah, they're setting the stage for that.
Well, I'm sorry that we're out of time. We were joined here in the studio by Alini Piva. She is with the group Brazilian Expats for Democracy. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman announced that he will arrange for the deployment of an elite unit of Pakistani guards to protect him and other royal family members, ostensibly from his own people. We're joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Ali, when I was living and working in Bahrain more than 20 years ago, there was an elite Pakistani unit back then known as the U Group. And it came to Bahrain from Saudi Arabia. It had been protecting the Saudi royal family, and it went to Bahrain to protect the Bahraini royal family. And then it went away after a few years. Why are the Saudis bringing this elite Pakistani unit back to the kingdom?
This is the nature of the Gulf monarchy. They heavily relied on outside forces, mercenaries, to protect them. And I've seen that with my own eyes. I've seen those Pakistani troops you talked about in driving on the highway and in my city. We saw them in also in other Gulf countries. Because these regimes, especially the Saudi monarchy, does not represent the people, that the people actually do not want them to be in power, they must rely on outside forces. They have relied on their outside forces in terms of the Great Britain for establishment of the Saudi state and the support that it's provided to them. And then, of course, now they rely on the United States protection from, according to officials, American officials who admitted, against local or domestic foes and external threats. And this is nothing new for those regimes, for those absolute monarchies. They will rely on these forces, mercenaries, to protect them from their own people. UAE, for example, the head of their presidential guard is from Australia. And the same thing in other, in Bahrain, which has a lot of Pakistani forces and different nationalities. While the local population of Bahrain, the majority of the population, are not allowed to be policemen. This is apartheid, obviously. So this is what you have in the Gulf.
Yeah, they're not allowed to be in the police force. They're not allowed to be in the intelligence services, and they're not allowed to be officers in the military.
Meaning the Shiite parts of the population.
Correct.
The Shia majority.
The majority, yes.
The Shia majority, yeah.
So when I say that that the Saudis simply can't trust their own people to protect the royal family, I'm not overstating the case.
Absolutely, you're not. That's since the foundation of the Saudi state, they relied on imports to be their outside. Even now, in for example, look at the Saudi embassy here. The talking mouse, the Saudi mouthpieces in Washington. Their fathers were foreigners who came to the country to serve as, either political or military mercenaries. And now their sons carried on that goal. So it is true that there is no trust between the ruling family in Saudi Arabia and the population. This is nothing new. Everybody knows it for different reasons. Now, it's now the greater challenge for the Saudi monarchy vis-a-vis its population. It's one of the greatest times that the population is greatly dissatisfied. Not in one region, but across the country.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio with co-host John Kiriakou. Ali, let's ask you a follow-up question. The Pakistani military announced that this Praetorian Guard, so to speak, was being deployed to Saudi Arabia. It's not a small group. It's a brigade-size operation. It's 1,000 trainers. 1,000 soldiers joined by advisors and trainers. What does it mean? And you've been telling us about the big picture, and this has gone on for decades. Intermittently, the Saudi royal family and the other royal families of the Gulf have relied on foreigners as their personal protection. But talk about the rule of the new crown prince and whether we're at a point of particular instability within the royal family in Saudi Arabia.
Since Mohammed bin Salman came to the political scene, he has been basically a bulldozer. He has been pushing everybody away from his way, and now he controls the entire political, military, security apparatus and the economic apparatus in the country. So it's all on one person. And he did that by not only cracking down on the population, but also removing his uncles and cousins from his way, and including actually one of his brothers. So you are looking at a person who is a demagogue, who is really carries the character of a classic despotic you know, a megalomaniac in many ways, because it's all about him and he can do things. In fact, they have not done anything so far. There's a lot of talk, but a lot of hot air, I would say. But in reality, if you examine what he has achieved, you see nothing. It's a mirage. And this is nothing new for the Saudi ruling family. They have been saying this for decades. We are going to do this. They promised you the moon, but you get nothing at the end of the day.
You know, when Saddam Hussein was in power in Iraq, there were several different layers of security around him. There were the Special Republican Guard immediately around him, made up of members of his Tikriti clan, specifically from the village of Auja, where he came from in central Iraq.
True.
But around that circle was the Republican Guard. Around that circle was the military. Is this what the Saudis are doing now? Mohammed bin Salman has arrested or exiled so many people who otherwise might have been his natural allies, as you said, family members, even his own brother. Is it at the point now where he just simply can't trust any other Saudis to protect him?
Well, from my sources, that he is extremely uncomfortable. He's very suspicious. And we will hopefully in the next few weeks, we'll be publishing two things about that. But in a nutshell, the guy is very hyper. He does not like difference of opinions. And because he's a big individual, he uses force to get his way. And he's a bully, really. And he did that to not only to the population, but to his own family. Unlike Saddam relied on Iraqi forces. You know, yes, they were from Auja and from Tikrit, from his region. True, but he relied on imported mercenaries. Now, Blackwater is working as his own guard. He does not trust the Saudis. He's afraid of being killed or poisoned. So he relies on external forces, just like his grandfather did. Early on, you know, in King Abdulaziz, the founder of Saudi Arabia, Henry Shakespeare is a British officer who was leading the forces of King Abdulaziz, and he was killed in a called Job battle. So this is the type of person he is. He's relying on foreign forces or mercenaries to protect him. You have Americans and so on. When Saad al-Hariri was detained, the Lebanese prime minister, they were all foreigners, not Saudis, and that's what Mohammed bin Salman is doing. That's why he's bringing the Pakistanis and their other via the UAE. He's using maybe Colombians and Americans and British mercenaries and others. We will find out. You know, a few years will all come to the public.
Ali, let's talk about what the Pakistanis get out of the Saudi-Pakistan relationship. You have the United States having a frostier relationship with Pakistan right now. At the same time, it's got a very close, deep relationship, profoundly deep relationship with the Saudi royal family. But talk about what the Pakistanis get out of all of this.
Well, Pakistan has been always a country that provided fighters, even under the occupation or colonization of the British Empire, and they continued to do that in the Gulf early on, when parts of the Gulf at least were under the British mandate. The police force were made out of Indians and Pakistanis mostly, and that continued on. And the tradition that Pakistan has huge population and a bad economy, so they see it as a revenue stream. And they send their soldiers and fighting men to other countries to make money. And that's what they have been doing in the Gulf. Of course, they will say, oh, this is about Islam protecting Mecca and Medina. But this is nonsensical. It's all about really the corruption of the Pakistani government and their willingness to do anything for a buck, as we say here. So I think this is going to continue. Pakistan has provided support for other Gulf countries against their own population, and they will do it here, especially to the Saudis. They have a long history of doing that.
Ali, I note in a piece in the AI Monitor today the fact that the Pakistani general who's in charge of this unit, this brigade size unit, had meetings with both the Iranian and Turkish ambassadors in Islamabad, and then made a trip to Doha to speak with the Qatari emir to tell all of these people that this group is not going to be any threat to their countries or to their forces in the region. Besides money and possibly citizenship for the men involved in this unit, what other benefits could possibly accrue to Pakistan? We have about 30 seconds left.
It's all about money for the Pakistani generals, it does not mean that because the U.S. has a frost relationship that the U.S. would not suggest. The U.S., I think now, is what they're doing. They're using others to fight their battle. They don't want Americans to die. They rather have Pakistanis die, and it's cheaper. And that's what they're outsourcing. The United States is outsourcing part of its regional power place.
That's about the size of it. It's outsourcing. Well, we were joined from Washington by Ali Al-Ahmed. He is the director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
4 years ago today, the protests in Maidan in downtown Kiev in Ukraine reached their bloody climax. Snipers had killed protesters and police officers. Later today, 4 years ago, armed groups stormed the parliament, seized the power, drove the corrupt but democratically elected government of Viktor Yanukovych out of the country. And the U.S. Washington establishment hailed this as a great new day for Ukraine. We are joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of the Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad you remembered this coup. I'm sure it won't be reported in the U.S. media, I don't think, very much.
Well, you know, the funny thing was I had kind of forgotten about today as the anniversary. But the State Department sent out a message to a credentialed press, so I got one, hailing today. It was like this great press release. Now, Kevin Zeese, this is not rhetoric to say the people who stormed the parliament, disbanded the government, carried out this coup, this putsch. These were neo-Nazis. I'm not saying that as a rhetorical flourish. And yet you have the Democrats, the Republicans, the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, John McCain. The entire Washington establishment was near euphoria. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I mean, and Victoria Nuland, who was assistant in the Secretary of State in that time, focused on Ukraine, admitted the U.S. spent $5 billion to create an opposition in Ukraine, which, of course, led to the coup. There are reports that both the U.S. and EU funded these right-wing, and they are extreme, they are neo-Nazis. I mean, the western part of Ukraine was much, much more closely allied with Hitler than the rest of Ukraine, and a very different personality. They have swastika-like signs that they use, and it's really very, looks like a Hitler type of mentality there. And they became the kind of the leaders of it. The coup was really interesting to follow, the protesters to follow, because they were really amazing. They took over Kiev for a long time in the winter, built all sorts of buildings, and it was really an amazing encampment that just occupied the city, the capital city, and then it developed into the more aggressive finale. And people, you mentioned John McCain, he would actually go out there and be in the protest, giving flowers and food to the protest. John McCain, a protester. Is that bizarre? Just the idea. And so were Victoria Nuland and the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. They were out in the protest as well. And it was really, so it was a very open coup. And yet the U.S. denied it. And making it more open was that Vice President Biden's son and John Kerry's longtime ally, college roommate, financier, were put on the board of the largest private gas company in Ukraine. They were put on the board of directors. But of course, it wasn't a coup. And their finance minister was a former employee for the U.S. State Department. She was made a Ukraine citizen the day she became finance minister.
Yeah, and so it was a takeover. It was an American takeover of Ukraine, which was the second biggest republic in the USSR, the Soviet, and the historic ally, closest historic ally of Russia.
The same thing happened in Croatia when Croatia became an independent country. The Minister of Defense was an American citizen and had to actually apply to get Croatian citizenship so he could be the Minister of Defense. It's kind of a soft way of taking over countries.
Yeah, aided though.
It's amazing how open we are about that, and then deny it's a coup.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, when you disperse the parliament with armed troops, armed militias, in this case, these are Nazis and neo-Nazis. But let's go back, too, because we have more sort of information about what happened. There was a lot of covert operations going on, undoubtedly.
Yes.
The U.S.
Yes.
says Victoria Nuland, who was the Secretary of State, undersecretary at that time, who was leading the charge, said the U.S. had spent $5 billion since 1991 for, quote, democracy, meaning meddling in Ukraine, trying to shape its politics.
Mm-hmm.
She had also been the senior advisor to Dick Cheney and then became Hillary Clinton's spokesperson when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State in 2009. She was the one overheard on a tape phone call saying to the EU, F you to the EU representative. We need Yats, meaning Yatsenyuk, to be the new leader of Ukraine. And sure enough, after the fascist-led coup, Yatsenyuk became the prime minister, at least for a while, in Ukraine. It was a takeover of a country. But on
and Yats fits that image of the neo-Nazi. You know, he went to Germany. He was denying the Holocaust. People in Germany couldn't believe it. The prime minister of Ukraine is denying the Holocaust. That's just bizarre.
Yeah, these are real Nazis.
The day before the coup, and that would be February 20th, 2014, unknown snipers shot at people. They were stationed up on the tall buildings above Maidan, this is central Kiev, and they just opened fire, killing 49 protesters and 4 police officers. And for many, that seemed to be like the final coup de grace for Yanukovych, because everyone thought that's Yanukovych or Yanukovych's police that were doing the shooting. And then there was an agreement.
Yeah, but they shot people from both sides. It was very bizarre.
Exactly. They shot police officers who were working with the Yanukovych government. They shot protesters. Now we have a story, and Sputnik got this story, with the people who say they were the snipers. And these were people who were from Georgia, another former Soviet republic. They insist that they were taking orders from the Maidan leaders. They had direct orders to fire at police officers and protesters in order to enrage the crowd and provoke a political crisis. Now, these people have come forward, and we've done a lot of digging on this to see whether or not this is a credible story. It appears at this point to be a credible story. So you have the armed and civil opposition to Yanukovych, or at least some segment of it. Of course, not most of the people were there. Most of the people were there because they wanted a pro-Western government, or they wanted change, or they were against corruption. I'm not talking about most people. But the right wing, the hard right, and those linked either to German intelligence or to American intelligence, they had regime change in mind. And there's nothing like shooting people who are, quote, peacefully protesting, mowing them down with this massacre by snipers that would more enrage a situation. And that's when Yanukovych then agreed to withdraw the police from Maidan the next day, today, February 21st, 2014. And soon as he withdrew the police, the U.S.-backed Nazi militias seized the power and created, quote, new Ukraine, which today's State Department is celebrating once again. Kevin, we have about 2 minutes left. The new government, Poroshenko's government, said its top priority is to bring Ukraine into NATO, which will put NATO right on Russia's border. But for the people of Ukraine, life has gone down, down, down. I mean, all they have is austerity. The country is a mess.
The country is a mess, and it couldn't get worse. The Trump administration is now arming the Kiev against eastern Ukraine, which is the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine. It's very possible we could see a war kind of a civil war between East and West Ukraine in the next year. It would be a disaster, of course, on Russia's border to create chaos, which is part of the reason why the U.S. is there, to create chaos on the Russian border. And so it's a mess that is likely to get worse. And it's also important to remember that when this coup happened, we were less than a year away in Ukraine from presidential elections. So this they could have gotten a regime change through electoral process, but very likely they would have failed. And so they took this approach instead. And so the U.S., as often does, removes democracy and substitutes a U.S.-supported administration that pretends to be a democracy. And that's what we're faced with Ukraine right now.
I mean, can you imagine Russians coming to Occupy protests, Russian government officials from different parties, and handing cookies and flowers out to people and saying, keep going, guys, wish you well.
When we did Occupy in Washington, D.C., our RT studios were about 4 or 5 blocks away. And I remember seeing some of their reporters walking by Occupy and urging them to come and join us. And they refused it. They just kept on walking. So they were smarter than the United States. They stayed away.
Yeah. And anyway, we have a situation where 4 years ago, a corrupt, democratically elected government was overthrown in a military coup d'etat supported by the United States after the United States had spent $5 billion allegedly on democracy in Ukraine.
Right.
And again, I don't think, John, this story is not going to reach the mainstream media, or certainly not in the right way it should be told.
No, you and I read all the main major papers across the country every day. We look at all the mainstream websites every day, and none of this is in there.
All right. We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can check out his writings and the other writings of people in Popular Resistance at PopularResistance.org.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Love.